The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
All right. Well, good morning. Great to see you all this morning. I am Christiana Holcomb, and I'm an attorney with Alliance Defending Freedom. And we are here today to talk about something that everybody wishes we didn't have to talk about, right? You would love to be able to skip my session and move on to some other things. But we've got some issues in today's day and age and culture that we've got to deal with and be prepared for, right? Sexual orientation, gender identity lawsuits. Well, a private Christian school in New Mexico recently received a very run-of-the-mill student application, right? It was for a little three-year-old boy, adorable little guy, who wanted to enroll in this year's preschool class. He and his daddy were excited. The school was excited to have him on board. They said, hey, let's just get some paperwork completed, and you'll be ready to roll. But then the school started doing a little bit more digging. And the school realized that this little boy had not only one daddy, but two. The child was being raised by two men in a homosexual relationship. The school immediately started backpedaling and said, look, we're so incredibly sorry, but your lifestyle, your belief system is directly antithetical to everything that our school stands for and believes. And so an educational relationship in this situation really is impossible. So they told the little boy and his dad that the child would not be able to enroll in the school that fall. Well, shortly thereafter, you can guess what happened next. The school received notice that it had been sued for sexual orientation discrimination. Headmasters, school administrators, school board members, are you all prepared to deal with these issues in your Christian school? Do you have policies in place to address issues of sexual orientation and gender identity? Because like it or not, Christian schools are seeing a dramatic increase in requests to admit, A, the children of same-sex couples, or B, to admit children that struggle with their sexual identity. Right? Some schools have a little boy one year who re-enrolls as a little girl the next year. What are you going to do about that? Do you have policies in place to address that? So today I want to talk about some very practical ways in which you can prepare your school to address issues of sexual orientation and gender identity so that you can proactively prepare your school, but then also, secondly, place your school in a strong legal position so that your attorneys can defend your religious freedom should it come to litigation. We pray that it does not. But we've got to be prepared, right? The horse is prepared for the day of battle, knowing that victory rests with the Lord. Our ultimate goal here is not to exclude people from our school. Our ultimate goal is to help you maintain a faithful gospel witness and to carry out the mission that Christ has laid upon you and your school, right? That's what we're trying to do here. So before we look at these practical steps, let's make sure we have a good understanding of the current cultural and legal landscape within which we're operating. So let's start by identifying the threat. If you've consumed any media, any blog posts, any Facebook or Twitter feeds in the last, year, 2 years, 5 years, you know that we are in a culture that increasingly devalues religious freedom and increasingly values, and not only values, but celebrates complete sexual license and deviance. And we're seeing that particularly in the areas of sexual orientation or homosexual behavior and in gender identity issues. As it pertains to sexual orientation and homosexual behavior, this is no longer something that's committed in secret, right? It's celebrated from the housetop, even from our most powerful political figures, President Obama. We've had two Supreme Court justices that recently officiated at same-sex weddings. Right? Speaking of the Supreme Court, they are currently putting the finishing touches on a decision that will decide whether or not the people of the United States remain free to affirm marriage as exclusively the union between one man and one woman, or whether nine unelected Supreme Court justices are going to impose same-sex marriage on all 50 states. And we expect to have that decision in the next couple of weeks. So that's the current same-sex marriage climate in which we're operating. But even moving beyond that, in the gender identity realm, it gets even stranger. How many of you saw the news about Bruce Jenner in the last couple of weeks? How did you not see the news about Bruce Jenner? Right? Bruce Jenner, a 1970s era Olympic athlete, a man's man, appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine June 1st, appearing as a woman. He had undergone hormone replacement therapy, surgical procedures, and inches of makeup. But inches and inches of makeup will never make a man a woman. Right? God has created each one of us uniquely to reflect his image as either male or as female. Bruce Jenner needs help, not celebration. But our culture is celebrating this type of insanity. Did you know that Facebook offers over 60 different gender options to choose from? Did you know that? 60? I can't even pronounce half of them, and I certainly don't know what they mean. And if the 60 different gender options doesn't cover how you identify, there's a certain custom option as well. You can create your own gender. Our culture has untethered biological sex from gender. And you know what that means? You're limited only by your imagination. Only by your imagination. Limitless possibilities. Well, this cultural insanity, as much as we'd like to see the Christian school is a bastion for truth and sort of braced off from some of this insanity, it's seeping into the Christian school context as well. We're seeing, again, an increase in issues in the student admissions process, not only along the lines of the school in New Mexico who received an application to admit a child of a same-sex couple, but again, students who are struggling with their sexual identity, who want to be transgender and identify as the opposite sex. Secondly, we're seeing an increase in issues in the employment context, your faculty and teachers. For example, in New York, there was a Christian school that employed a male music teacher for something like 17 years. He had been there for ages. But this male music teacher decided that he wanted to be a woman. He started dressing like a woman for class, using feminine pronouns, a feminine name, hormone replacement therapy, and decided he wanted the school to recognize him as a woman. What did the school have to do? Can you allow someone who is living a lifestyle antithetical to the scriptural teachings that the school is trying to communicate to the children, can you allow them to stay in a position of authority? No. So they had to dismiss this individual. And he then turned around and sued the school for gender identity discrimination. We're also seeing an increase in issues with student conduct. Again, if you've got a child who identifies as the opposite sex, what do they want access to? They want access to the opposite sex's locker rooms, bathrooms. What about playing on the opposite sex softball team, athletic programs? We're seeing an increase in these types of conflicts. One private school, for example, in California, had two high school girls that were involved in a homosexual lesbian relationship. The school had to undertake disciplinary action against them and ultimately dismiss them from the Christian school because they were disruptive in that way. And what did the girls turn around and do? They sued their private Christian school for sexual orientation discrimination. This is the context, the cultural context in which you now operate. Even if to date you have not had any issues in this regard, I really see this as a matter not of if, but of when. Which is why I'm so happy to see all of you here today so that we can proactively start preparing for these issues and hopefully forestall a problem and avert litigation. But as law follows culture, so too this cultural revolution is having an impact on our legal system. So let's talk briefly about that current legal landscape in which we're operating. The primary legal weapon of the sexual revolution, you may be surprised to find, is not same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage, make no mistake, is having a cultural impact, but it is far more subtle and will be longer term for us to see the fruits and repercussions of that. But in the here and now, in the immediate term, the primary legal weapon of the sexual revolution is what we call non-discrimination ordinances. Non-discrimination ordinances, just like they sound, they prohibit discrimination based on certain protected classifications. Historically, this was a good thing, right? The protected classifications were things that were innate, immutable, obvious characteristics, like race, like color, like national origin, like sex or gender. These innate, obvious characteristics about a person that they can't change, that no one should be allowed to discriminate against another person based off of. But what are activists doing now? They're adding categories like sexual orientation and gender identity to these non-discrimination ordinances. And I like to call these laws SOGIs. So named for the first letter of each word, sexual orientation, gender, identity. When we insert sexual orientation and gender identity into non-discrimination laws, that's really a long and convoluted mouthful to say, right? So we're going to call them SOGIs for short, just to identify what types of laws we're talking about. But SOGIs make it illegal for businesses or for public places to make any distinction among people, period, based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The problem with these laws is that they carry a lot of power. They have teeth. So the penalties for violation can include civil and criminal fines, and some of them even include jail time. This is serious business. These non-discrimination laws are nothing to wink at. They carry hefty penalties. So, quick civics lesson. Everybody knows we've got three different levels of our government, right? We've got the federal, we have the state, and the local or city level as well. The good news is that currently there is no SOGI at the federal level. All right? Breathe a sigh of relief. But approximately 50% of states nationwide do have a SOGI. Those states, as you can see on the screen, that are dark green in color and have a T emblem on the inside, currently have a SOGI. They protect on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity across the state. So quickly look and see where you fall. Those that are lighter green in color only right now include sexual orientation. But those that are light green in color do not currently have a SOGI at the statewide level. All right? But lest you breathe a sigh of relief and decide, well, hey, I have to listen to the rest of this one. I am in a cream-colored state. Not so fast. We have a third tier of government, right? The local or the city level as well. What you need to know is that most major metropolitan areas across the nation, even in the cream-colored states, have a SOGI at the city or at the county level. So, for example, while the state of Texas does not have a statewide SOGI, places like Houston, Dallas, Austin most likely do. All right, those are the SOGIs that you must be most cognizant of. Activists are dedicating millions and millions of dollars over the next 10 years, and I'm not exaggerating. I think it's upwards of $100 million is what they have specifically dedicated to passing SOGIs in all the remaining cream-colored states. So this is an ongoing battle. This map is constantly in flux, and it's constantly changing, something that we have to be very vigilant about. So what does that mean for your Christian school? The good news is that SOGIs only apply right now to public places. And the good news is that Christian schools are not automatically, under the law, considered to be public places such that fall under SOGIs. The bad news is that activists, obviously, when they're passing these laws, are trying to pass them as broadly as they possibly can. They're trying to ensure that your school falls beneath a SOGI and must comply with a SOGI. So what we want to do, we have three big picture objectives for your school. Big picture number objective of number one, if I can talk this morning, is A, to make your school look less like a public place and more like a private institution, as it most likely was designed to be, was it not? It's not indiscriminately open to the public and anyone who wants to enroll their child. We have certain standards, all right? It's a private institution, a private associational institution. The second thing we want to do for your school is to help position you in such a way that you can take advantage of any religious exemptions within the law. Many SOGIs, as badly as they are written, do include some type of exemption for religious organizations or religious educational institutions. We want to ensure that your school can take advantage of those laws. All right? And third and finally, we want to ensure that your school is able to take advantage of any constitutional defenses that we could raise on your behalf, particularly those that would fall from the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment and the Free Association Clause of the First Amendment. Those are kind of our big picture objectives for your school today. So how do we make that happen? What does that look like in practical steps? Let's talk about section number 2, strategically protecting your Christian school. There are really 4 steps that I recommend every Christian school undertake, and in this order. Step number 1, let's talk about some foundational questions that school board administrators, headmasters, and board members need to, first of all, consider. Who is my school called by God to serve? Who am I called to serve? There are 2 broad categories, although there may be some shades of gray in the middle. But is your school, first of all, called to serve Christian families? Are you more discipleship oriented? Are you going to come alongside Christian mothers and fathers to help them disciple and educate their children? These families that agree with your statement of faith, that agree with the ultimate objectives, that are kingdom oriented alongside you, are you called to minister primarily to Christian families as a discipleship school? Or on the other side, are you still a distinctively Christian school, but are you more evangelistic and missional in nature? Is your calling to, yes, not only come alongside Christian families, but to welcome non-Christian families into your fold as well, as long as they're willing to acknowledge that these are the scriptures that we teach. We teach in accordance with a biblical worldview. This is the type of education your child will receive. As long as they're good with that, willing to sign on the bottom line, you'll come alongside them and welcome their child. What is your calling? Who are you called to serve? Now, I hope you understand there is no right or wrong answer here. And if you choose one path or the other, that doesn't mean that necessarily your defenses are any less. But you have to be convinced in your own mind of the calling that God has laid upon your school. Who are you called to serve? This is foundational because it's going to set the trajectory for how you apply the remainder of the steps that we're going to talk about today. The policies you implement are going to depend on how you answer question number 1. Well, question number 2 is, what do my school's religious beliefs require in the area of marriage, gender, and human sexuality? You may think at first that that's a bit of a strange question. I'm sure all of us in this room would agree that marriage is exclusively the union between one man and one woman. We may agree on the broad principle, but how it plays out in application to your school may look differently. What I call your conscience line. Our conscience lines may differ. What is the line that you cannot cross without feeling that you have crossed a boundary? So, for example, does it violate your school's religious convictions to acknowledge a same-sex couple as head of household? Could you do that? If yes, then, you know, you need to have policies in place, admissions policies in place, that would not admit those types of families. But if not, if perhaps you're called to be more missional in purpose and in calling, then no, maybe you can recognize 2 men as a head of household. Or does it violate your religious convictions to offer a unisex bathroom to children who struggle with their sexual identity? Let's say you've got a little 6- or 7-year-old. The child comes to you and says, well, mommy says that I can be a boy if I want to be a boy. If I feel like I'm a boy in my brain, then I get to be a boy, right? Well, are you going to force that biological little girl to use the restrooms that associate with her biological sex that may be uncomfortable for her personally, or will you provide a unisex restroom? These are the types of applications you've got to work through as a school board to figure out, where is our conscience line? Where are we going to draw the line? Even within the Association of Classical and Christian Schools, our conscience lines may differ, and that's okay. Because where religious beliefs are at issue, there is no one-size-fits-all. You've got to work through the particular context in which you're operating and the religious beliefs of your particular school. So, foundational questions for step number 1, who is my school called to serve, and what do my school's religious beliefs require? Only when you have finished wrestling with these questions should you move on to step number 2. Step number 2, governing documents. Within your bylaws or other governing policies, there are 2 particular items that you need to pay close attention to: your mission statement and your statement of faith. And we'll look at each one in turn. Mission statement. Your mission statement establishes the purpose of your school, why you're even in existence. Why do we operate? Why are we here? Your mission statement, if you are truly a religious school, should establish a religious reason for your existence. Right? That seems really basic, but you would be surprised at the number of Christian schools I talk to that their mission statement only talks about education or talks about a classical type education, an educational philosophy. If this is all undergirded and motivated by your religious convictions, that should be detailed in your mission statement. So, for example, your mission might be to train the next generation of Christian leaders and equip them for a life of service to their home, their Savior, their churches, and their communities. That would be a distinctly religious reason for your school's existence. If the primary purpose of your school is not religious and you can't come up with one to insert, you are not a religious school. We may have some other constitutional protections in the private arena for you, but the religious exemptions and protections will not apply. But in addition to establishing a distinctly religious mission for your school, two other things that I like to see, a speech component and an associational component. And here's what I mean. In the speech component, this is just a message that the school wants to communicate to the outside world. And it might help just to provide an example. A school's purpose might be in part to share, right, a message, share the knowledge of life in Jesus Christ with our community, or to be a true representation of XYZ doctrine to the outside world. Now, you may be asking, this is a little bit silly, why would we include a speech component? Well, because we have a free speech clause in the First Amendment. We want to be able to raise as many constitutional defenses as we can for your school, and providing a speech component in writing will assist us in making those arguments. Similarly, an associational component. This is simply a desire to associate with like-minded individuals to further the school's religious purpose and mission. Right? If you're trying to accomplish someone, you got to get people on the same train heading in the same direction as you are, right? So part of the school's purpose and mission might be to associate with like-minded teachers, parents, and students to communicate the school's message, there's that speech component, to the world and train the next generation of Christian leaders. That's your religious component. You see how it all can seamlessly fit together? That's what I would like to see in your school's mission statement. Secondly, your statement of faith. Courts will give great deference to the self-identified religious beliefs of an organization, particularly if those beliefs appear in writing. Now, as an attorney, I am absolutely going to go to bat for you to defend the religious beliefs that you hold, even if they're not in writing. But you make my job so much easier. If I can point to a written document that says, we believe X, Y, and Z, and if that document was in place before the litigation arose. Do you know how sketchy it looks to create policies after you receive that phone call? That looks sketchy to the court. They pick up on that. You know, opposing counsel is always pointing that out, right? So I like to see these policies in place ahead of time. The statement of faith should be detailed. I recognize that you all want to most likely be very ecumenical and cast a broad brush and broad strokes, bring many people into the fold. But to the extent that you can be as detailed as possible, reflect the religious nature and character of your particular school, and especially if you're associated with a denomination. Highlight that fact. Make that clear. Make that known. But one subsection in particular that I want to see in your statement of faith, in light of what we're dealing with in today's culture, is a statement of religious belief concerning marriage, gender, and human sexuality. And frankly, I actually see this step as foundational, similar to the foundational questions we talked about earlier, but foundational to the remaining strategies. So I ask that you give this one particularly careful consideration. A school does not need to reduce its entire belief system to writing. In fact, that would be next to impossible, right? That would be quite onerous. But because marriage is a current, hot-button cultural issue, a battleground even within the church today, I think it's vital to have a written policy statement addressing what the school believes about marriage. Statements of faith include foundational, non-negotiable issues and commonly issues upon which there has been heresy in the past. I think marriage qualifies, all right, for inclusion within the statement of faith. So, what might you say? Something along the lines of, we believe that God has created marriage to be exclusively the union between one man and one woman, and that intimate sexual activity outside of marriage is to be prohibited, not to occur. Something as simple as that clarifies for not only for the school board, but for the student body, for potential parents, for potential faculty, for the culture at large, frankly. There are those who are looking for easy targets. We're not going to be overly dramatic, but there are those who are seeking test cases. You want to have policies in place that indicate to the culture at large where you stand on this issue. I also encourage schools to include a statement of religious belief concerning gender. And I tend to get a little bit more pushback from school administrators on this one. They get a little more angst about defining gender. But let's explain. Gender is such an axiomatic, foundational issue that Christians have a hard time talking about it. Like, we don't really know how to talk about what's wrong with the whole gender identity debate. Have you had this conversation before? It's difficult to explain, well, why does it matter how I dress or, you know, what sensitive areas, restrooms and locker rooms that I use? Why does that matter? Well, go back and ground your statement of faith in Genesis, right? We believe that God has wonderfully and immutably, can't be changed, immutably created each person as either male or as female, and these two distinct complementary genders together reflect the image and the nature of God. Okay, that could be your statement of religious belief concerning gender. You don't have to, don't say something negative along the lines of, we don't believe gender identity is a real thing. All right, that's not what we're going for here. Positively articulate, what do you believe? Why do we care about gender? Why is it such a foundational, important issue? The statement on marriage and the statement on gender, I want to see them seamlessly inserted into a statement of faith. Now, I recognize there are many pastors and many school administrators who are uncomfortable with that because they feel like inserting those statements into a statement of faith is messing with the creeds of old. And if that's your position, then what I would suggest is that you create a separate policy document for marriage, gender, and sexuality. But if you don't hold to that position, I think it's far preferable to see that within a statement of faith because it draws less attention to itself. I think the separate marriage policy is a bit of a bullseye in some respects. I think it draws unwarranted attention. These are important issues, of course, but these are not the only issues upon which we take a stand, correct? So I prefer to see them seamlessly inserted within a statement of faith. And you can do so. For example, a lot of statements of faith start with the Trinity and then the doctrine of creation and the fall of man. Oh, right between creation and the fall of man, that's a perfect place to talk about gender. We believe God has wonderfully and immutably created each one of us, X, Y, and Z. All right, you keep rolling on down. It talks about the work of Jesus Christ on the cross and his resurrection. All right, down towards the bottom of many statements of faith, they talk about current Christian living before they get to end time. Current Christian living, that's a great place to talk about marriage. We believe that God has created marriage to be X, Y, and Z. Do you see how that can be done? You have the policies in place to protect yourself, but no unwarranted attention is drawn to them. When religious groups come to us for help and have no written policies about marriage or gender, it's not to say that we can't make those arguments, but you have made our job significantly more difficult in the court of law. Okay? So, we've talked about step one, foundational questions, step two, governing documents, step three, school policies, and I have a number of them to hit through, and we're going to hit them pretty briefly here. First of all, admissions policies. This is the gatekeeping policy, right? Your school should have a well-defined admissions procedure that incorporates several circuit breakers in the process. This will allow you to either A, flag that there could be an issue. If you're more evangelistic and missional in nature, it simply flags it for you. You may not try to terminate the process, but you at least can be aware of it. If you are more discipleship-oriented in nature, it allows you to terminate the admissions process before you get all the way down the line like the New Mexico Christian School did and then said, oh, we are so sorry. We did not realize that's who you are. Okay? So some of the circuit breakers can take a number of different forms, but we suggest at a minimum, one, a detailed, very detailed application process that includes not only your religious mission statement, but your religious statement of faith that includes a statement of belief about marriage and gender. And then also talks about the criteria that you're going to use in evaluating each student on an individual basis. Not just academic criteria, but do you have spiritual and behavioral criteria that you use as well? Right? I'd like to see that in the initial information packet. Secondly, on your application include sections, this sounds really basic, but just sections for biological mother and biological father. If you happen to receive an application where biological mother is stricken out and you've got two fathers on the page, right, that highlights an issue for you, does it not? Especially if the names in and of themselves do not sound entirely feminine or masculine. Third, conduct personal interviews of every family. I know that may seem burdensome, but I hope you're doing so to protect yourselves anyway. Invite the entire family in. You can get a lot of insight into family dynamics and how the family operates and works and what their family life might be like in that personal interview. Fourth and finally, communicate a notice of admission or denial in writing. All right, I don't want to see anything done orally or over the phone. You may feel like you're protecting yourself by saying, well, let me just give them a quick call and say, hey, look, I'm so sorry, but we are a Christian school, and so your family life isn't consistent with what we believe, so I'm sorry, but no thanks. When I get a phone call a month later that you've received a complaint, it's very difficult for us to go back and prove what actually was said. Okay? It becomes a he said, she said thing. I'd much rather see it in writing. And if you do, by the way, need to send one of those letters, please contact us first for free. We would love to help you craft the language of that denial. All right, but incorporating these types of circuit breakers, and you may think of others, will help you terminate the process if it becomes necessary, and if it isn't necessary, it at least helps to highlight or flag the issue for you. Secondly, a code of conduct and or a student privacy policy. Hopefully your school already has in place a code of conduct. It probably addresses things like stealing and cheating or respect for authority, various prohibitions and or mandated types of conduct. I think it's also important to include a section briefly noting the necessity of having each child dress in conformance with their biological sex. Can you believe we've reached a point in our society where that's necessary? Now, you don't have to frame it like that if you don't want to. You can have something along the lines of a dress code. Boys are going to dress like young men. Our little girls are going to dress like young ladies, and that is what we require. But in addition to that, something along the lines of a student privacy policy, this can either be a separate policy or within the code of conduct. But you need to note the necessity of each child using the sensitive areas that associate with their biological sex. So if you want to do a student privacy policy, you could say something along the lines of, in light of privacy concerns, the need to maintain school discipline, and safety issues. I think it's fair to say that up front. In light of safety issues, we require that all students use the sensitive areas where they could be in various states of undress, such as the restroom, locker rooms, showers, and changing facilities that accord with their biological sex. Seems sad that we have to spell that out, but it is necessary, especially I feel if your school plays any type of sports, you don't know what the other school standards for their athletic programs are. So you realize your young women may be playing opposite of biological boys who identify as girls. Right? Those are some of the issues that even Christian schools are dealing with right now. So ground your code of conduct in your statement of faith. This is, again, why I think it's so important to have a statement of religious belief about gender. If you've got a child that comes to you and says, well, why can't I be a girl if I want to be a girl? Point them back to that statement of religious belief about gender and use it as a teaching opportunity, right? Third, curriculum, teacher instruction. Make sure, I know every single one of you, the reason you're here is because you identify both as a classical and as a Christian school. But are you ensuring that your children not only are taught from a biblical worldview, but receive actual religious instruction in the classroom? Does that occur within your classroom? There wasn't a Christian school in Hawaii that was denied a religious exemption. It was forced to comply with a SOGI because the emphasis of the school over time had shifted and deteriorated. It had moved from Protestant religious instruction to simply teaching students and equipping them with ethical principles that would allow them to make their own moral judgments. The court actually looked at this, detailed it in its opinion, talked about the fact that the school, while it had started out with a religious instruction, had sort of fallen into just operating within a Judeo-Christian framework. Can the same be said of your school? Okay, this is yet another factor that the courts are going to look at to determine whether or not you can obtain a religious exemption and or those religious constitutional defenses that we want to raise on your behalf. So ensure that your school is engaging in actual religious instruction and not simply operating within a Protestant framework. Talk to the kids about who God is, what he is doing, what he requires of them. In fact, I would have something along these lines denoted in your employment contracts with your teachers. Ensure that they understand this is required of them. Okay? So, admissions policies, code of conduct, curriculum, fourth, handbook, student, parent, and teacher handbook. Every single handbook, without exception, should include your religious mission statement and your statement of faith. I like to see that in as many policy documents as I can. They are foundational, are they not? The operation of your school. Include a warning, though, in your handbook that they are subject to change without notice by decision of the governing board. The reason I include that is because we have seen a situation where a school included a non-discrimination code within their student handbook. A child sued the school for what he thought was the violation of that non-discrimination code, and he did so on the basis of a contract action. He claimed that the student handbook created a contract, a promise that the school had made to the student. We want to avoid that happening. So I just recommend including a warning that the handbooks are subject to change without notice and that they do not create a contract between school and employee, between school and student. Next, require all employees, parents, or students, especially those in grades 7 through 12, to sign a statement within the handbook saying that we have read the school's religious mission statement and statement of faith, and we are willing to abide by them. We're willing to be bound by them. If you, again, are a discipleship-oriented school and you minister only to Christian families and Christian students, then I would include yet another section stating that they hold to these beliefs as well. Take it even stronger language. Not only have we read it, we're in agreement with it, we hold to these beliefs and we're willing to be bound by them. If you are more evangelistic and missional in nature, you're not going to include the section stating that we hold to these beliefs, but you do need to have a section noting that they acknowledge that this is what the school stands for and teaches, and they are willing to have their child, or the child is willing to be educated in accordance with them. All right? Ensure that all of these signed statements are kept on copy in the school's administrative file. Employment policies. Religious schools should and generally are free to hire and fire based on their religious beliefs. That's a right that is guaranteed you by the First Amendment. But you can take best advantage of those protections by having two particular components in your religious your employment policies. First of all, again, require all employees to affirm that they hold to the school statement of faith. They believe it, and they're willing to be bound by it. And note, even within your employment contract, that violation of those standards is good cause to terminate employment. Have that written down. Have that there. As far as best practices go, have each employee sign in writing that they have agreed to that statement. And, again, note the failure to abide by them is good cause for termination. But secondly, include very detailed written job descriptions. Pastors and churches are really bad about this. School administrators tend to be a little bit better, but not always up to par. I want to see a written job description for every single position in your Christian school. But not only should you define the physical job duties, the administrative responsibilities of the position, but take it a step further. You're a religious school. Are you detailing the religious responsibilities, the spiritual criteria for your position? Are you? So detail not only the spiritual responsibilities, but also explain how it furthers the school's religious mission. Again, if everyone is trying to accomplish a big picture goal for the kingdom of God, are you bringing alongside you to help accomplish this mission people who are like-minded and are trying to achieve those same goals? Detail it. It's especially important for legal purposes that you include and detail any ministerial, teaching, or spiritual qualifications or responsibilities on the job description. Now, why do I say that? Have any of you heard of a case called Hosanna Tabor? This is a case, yes, that went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, a 9-0 decision affirming what's called the ministerial exception to employment non-discrimination law. All that fancy lingo just means that even the United States Supreme Court recognized that in the context of a Christian school, if you have individuals who have some jobs that maybe your pastor might do or that a minister might do, such as teaching doctrine, such as praying, such as leading chapel, that the government is hands off. That is the province of the Christian school to make those hiring and firing decisions. So I want to help you create and structure your employment policy such that you look, your teachers look more ministerial rather than simply straight up academic teachers. Okay? You'll have stronger religious liberty protection. So lay out spiritual qualifications. Talk about if they lead chapel, detail that they will be required to do so X number of times a year. They'll be required to pray with students, to counsel them one-on-one during off-school hours. Any spiritual or religious qualifications. All right. Facility use policy. I don't know how many of you own your school facility, but for those of you that do, and if you permit your school facility to be used outside of normal business operations, got to have a facility use policy in place. No exceptions. The facility use policy should detail the religious nature of the facility and then specify how it may be used. And what we're trying to avoid here is having organizations come in and say, well, you let the Boy Scouts use it, or you let XYZ social group borrow your gym. Why can't I use it for my same-sex wedding, anniversary, you name it? All right, those are the types of questions we want to avoid. So have a detailed facility use policy that first and foremost details the religious nature of the facility. But the facility has been given to us by God to be used exclusively for His glory. Therefore, we cannot permit any uses that are contrary to our religious beliefs or convictions. Because we can't have any material cooperation with actions that we believe to be sinful. So, we will only permit uses that are consistent with our religious beliefs. Detail the religious nature of the facility. Have a detailed application process that has to be approved by a member either of the school board or of your administration and so forth. And then, again, address some facility use guidelines. A good place to talk about setup and tear down and cost and all those types of things. But just something to be thinking about. If you allow your facility to be used outside of normal business operations, have a facility use policy. Because what we don't want to happen is for you to allow a lot of social groups in and for them to then sue and say that you are a public place under a SOGI. That's what we're trying to avoid here. All right? Final step, step number 4, school presentation. The final step in the evaluation process is to examine how your school appears to the outside world. Emphasize your religious character. Highlight it. Shout it from the rooftop. Things along the lines of, look at your website. What do people see when they go to your website? What do they know and learn about you? Would they understand, well, sure, they're a private Christian, private school, but would they recognize you as distinctively Christian? Look at your website. What about your brochures? Again, this is kind of a snapshot for the outside world to get a glimpse at who you are and what you're all about. If you're a distinctly religious school, that should be made very, very clear on your website, your brochures, your tagline, your logo. Okay? This, again, gives the outside community a look into who you are. If you're affiliated with a church or religious denomination, highlight that. A lot of religious organizations and Christian schools kind of downplay it. Like, well, we're affiliated with the Lutheran church, but I don't want the Baptists to be uncomfortable coming here or feel like we're only catering to Lutherans. It all depends on how you frame it, but those organizations and schools that have strong ties to a local church or religious denomination, guess what? They have stronger religious liberty protection. They do, because they look to the government and to the courts more like a church and more like a church ministry or offshoot. Even things as basic and kind of funny as having religious texts or pictures up on your wall. Did you know there are published court opinions that have analyzed details like that? Well, in looking across their building, they do have a lot of religious texts and Bible verses up on the wall and religious prints. Now, it doesn't mean you have to go to town on it, but that is yet another consideration for how you're presenting yourself to the community. But the bottom line is, how would the community characterize your Christian school? Is your school religious in name only? Are you kind of like that Hawaiian Christian school that sort of defaulted to Judeo-Christian principles and framework? If that is who you are, then be that to the glory of God. But do not expect to be able to take advantage of religious exemptions and religious constitutional defenses. Okay? In conclusion, I want to leave you with a warning. All right? Don't turn this into something that it isn't. Don't say that you have a mission of training up the next generation of Christian leaders if what God has actually called you to is simply to train and to educate children, public policy leaders and so forth. If you, again, are going to be a distinctly religious organization, highlight it. Play it up. Don't downplay your religious identity. In fact, we have a saying at Alliance Defending Freedom that use it or lose it. Use your religious identity or risk losing some of the defenses that you would have otherwise had. I know that's kind of counterintuitive. In many ways, it's a paradox, similar to the one that Jesus Christ talked about in the book of Mark. You know, he who would save his life must lose it, and he who would lose his life for my sake will ultimately save it. There's a similar paradox at work here. He who says, here I stand, I can do no other. This is who I am in Jesus Christ. This is what I believe, regardless of the winds of cultural change around me. This is what God has called me to be. Your religious liberty defenses are going to be stronger and heightened and more robust than the school that says, oh, good heavens, we certainly can't put that in writing, but we believe marriage is the beginning of a man and a woman. You've got to do that because that'll make us a target. Those schools that don't have those clear policies actually are a bit more of the murky middle. They're going to be a bit more of a target for individuals who are trying to create the test cases right now. So the key, relate your religious beliefs to everything that you do. Well, Alliance Defending Freedom has developed a free legal guide to help you with this. Does this feel a little bit overwhelming? That's a lot of homework to take home, isn't it? But ADF has developed a free legal guide called Protecting Your Ministry, and it's designed not only for Christian schools, but also for churches and Christian ministries like nonprofit pregnancy resource centers or homeless shelters, things like that, to help them proactively take a serious look at their bylaws, at their governing policies and documents, to help put them in a strong legal position should they be challenged on issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. We also have included a number of sample policies, so you don't have to create things from scratch. Like that facility use policy, we have a full-blown sample in our resource. We have sample statements on marriage and gender. We have sample school policies. Now, the caveat is, if I give this to you and you take the policies that I've written, I don't ever want to see them look exactly like that in your school policies. Take them. Tailor them, adapt them to your specific school. The worst thing you can do is pick up great-looking policies from other schools, plop them into your documents, and not follow them. You know why? Because when you get to litigation, opposing counsel is going to exploit that, and you're going to look insincere to the court, and there's nothing worse than looking insincere to the court. They will then question whether any of your religious beliefs are sincere in that regard. So please, take what we've done, tailor them, adapt them, prayerfully consider them, and start implementing them as quickly as possible. There's also in this resource a checklist for Christian schools. So it follows a bit of a different trajectory than the way I've presented them today, but there is a checklist within the first couple of pages of items that your school board should go over and discuss and prepare. We have free copies of them available on our Alliance Defending Freedom table, which is in the ballroom foyer. You're welcome to grab one. Actually, please take a couple. If you've got some friends or your pastor that could use them, we don't want to ship them home, so please take them. You're also welcome to download. We have free copies available online in a PDF form. You can download or shoot the link to your pastor and say, hey, let's start the conversation. Let's start talking about this. But know this, should your Christian school encounter legal trouble in this area, Alliance Defending Freedom has a team of attorneys that are dedicated to protecting the freedoms of religious schools. All right, for free. Everything we do is free to the body of Christ. Our mission is to ensure that you can continue faithfully carrying out the mission that God has called to you. Okay? That's what we're all about. So, that's all I have for you today. We have a couple minutes, and I would be happy to take questions. Yes.
Yeah. Targeted, was it
love to be able to say that it was naivety. But what we're seeing and what we're suspecting is that there are specific instances in which they're testing the water. Okay? I don't know if you know this, but there is what we call the homosexual high command, homosexual agenda high command, and they are trying to create test cases. Who is the last bastion of truth in America today as it pertains to human sexuality? It is the Church of Jesus Christ. And what are they seeking and craving more than anything else? Not only affirmation, but celebration. So your school to them, as they drive by, that's condemnation. They feel like it's condemnation. Now, that's certainly not the way that we would look at it at all. But if they can get their child into your Christian school, huh, look, the Church accepted me. Like, do you kind of see where that's headed? So in many respects, they're doing the same thing with churches as well and ministerial positions. I've got a couple clients right now who were fired. Excuse me. The churches are my clients, not the employees. I've got a couple churches that ended up having to fire ministers for engaging in same-sex behavior and in trying to have a same-sex marriage. And they turned around and sued the Church. They are trying to fundamentally change the Church and what she stands for. What they don't understand is the gospel of Jesus Christ and his truth never changes. We may go away, but the scriptures will remain the same and his truth about marriage will not be changed. So, yes, all that long answer to your question is yes. But I do want to clarify, not every inquiry you receive is going to be a test case. Some of them may genuinely just be trying to figure out who you are and what you stand for. So I don't want you to fear. We don't have a spirit of fear, right? But of a sound mind. So be wise as serpents and harmless as doves in this particular area especially. I think I saw your hand first. Go ahead. That's a great question. No, I certainly do not think so. I mean, you're just renting and borrowing their facilities, right? But I think it would be beneficial and a service to the Church if you would pass along the resource and say, look, these are the types of issues that you're vulnerable to. But no, the liability will not be passed along to your school. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you may get some pushback on this, so it's all going to depend on how you roll it out, how you frame it. If you say, look, families, we're all scared. The Supreme Court may just decided the marriage case, so we're all going down. It's all, I'm exaggerating here, but it all depends on how you frame it. If you maybe set up some, I don't know how large your schools are, but you may be able to set up some one-on-one meetings, or you might have a parents' night and just say, look, we all understand the culture in which we're operating. We also all understand that we are a Bible-based school. And so as a result, we want to take some practical preventative measures. Doesn't mean we're discriminatory. We want to love and serve everyone, but this is what we need to do to put our school in the best possible position to defend our religious freedom, so that we can continue to exist to serve you. But I would certainly recommend, even for those families that have been in your home, your schooling community for decades, absolutely everybody should be signing and affirming these policies. It's going to look actually a little bit weird to the court if some people do and some people don't. Yeah. Amen and amen. No, absolutely. I just want to add an exclamation point to what he said. Consistency is absolutely imperative. If the opposing counsel is able to show and demonstrate inconsistency in your application, however well-meaning it may be, that doesn't bode well for us at all. I think I saw one more hand. We've got just 2 minutes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Not per se. What I would see, we want to ensure that the handbook in and of itself comprehensively does not create a contract between the two parties. We don't want them to have any contractual basis to sue the school. But what we do want on the flip side is for them to sign what you could call an acknowledgement statement. You're not promising them anything in return, but this is essentially a written acknowledgement statement saying, I have read, I believe, and I am willing to abide by. And you can even title it as such. So, sure. One final question. Sure. Well, I will say that anything you say in writing that pertains to the situation is discoverable information. Unless it's to your spouse. I mean, there are certain limited exceptions to that. If you're emailing your attorney, if you're emailing your spouse, there are certain exceptions. But you should assume that if you are emailing another administrator on your school board, that that is discoverable if this goes to litigation. The other side, discoverable meaning the other side will be able to obtain. That's an excellent question as it pertains to the written denial. What we generally recommend is be err on the side of being more vague and generic. If there is a neutral basis to deny the child admission, another reason that he would not be accepted to the school, it might be worthwhile to list that. I think that's okay. But otherwise, you're welcome to say something along the lines of, you know, incompatible with the religious beliefs. We believe that an educational relationship would be impossible. Your child would be internally conflicted. You know, things of that nature, but I would keep it purposefully vague and at a very high level. Don't reference anything related to sexual orientation, homosexuality, homosexual behavior. I don't want to see those words anywhere near the letter. All right, well, thank you all so very much. I am around for the remainder of today. I'll be hanging out around the ADF booth. If you have other questions, I'd be happy to talk them through with you. Thank you all so much.